Okay, so we'll start with setting our motivation, and we'll use the refuge in bodhicitta prayer to do that. If you don't feel comfortable with the precise words of this prayer, go ahead and adjust them into things that touch your heart, maybe in an ideal such as compassion or kindness or peace. But let's just take a minute and make a really altruistic intention for doing this retreat and course. Sangye chodon sogi chodam lai janchu padu dani kapsu chi dagi chenyen ki pe sonam ki rola penche sangye rupa sho sangye chodon sogi chodam lai janchu padu dani kapsu chi dagi chanyan gi pe sonam gi rola penche sangye jupa sho sangye chodam sogi chonam la janchu padu dani kapsu chi dagi chanyan gi pe sonam gi rola penche sangye jupa sho. And so just letting your motivation connect to your heart. Not just for myself, not just for today. Although myself and today are included. Okay. So we're doing 37 practices of a bodhisattva by Tobme Zangpo. And this is a very old but very popular text in Tibetan Buddhism. And the reason I like this text is that it's kind of like a call to arms in a Buddhist way. It's kind of a triumphant, heroic, courageous, kind of inspirational poem. And the poem is kind of asking us to look really deeply into what blocks us from living our highest ideals. You know, we have a good heart, we're kind, we want to be wiser, we are already wise, but what is it that stands in our way? What is it that distracts us? Why don't we live by our highest ideals all the time, even though we treasure them so deeply? You know, we might think that being a compassionate listener and having assertiveness without anger is very important. But then in the heat of the moment, we get really critical or we get really harsh. And then afterwards, we wonder what happened to us. That's not who I am, you know, for example. Or we might think, I love living a simple, contented life with few possessions. And then when we're stressed or we're hungry or we're distracted or there's stuff going on at work, suddenly we're online binge buying. And afterwards we think, I didn't need that. Why did I do that? You know, you go on to buy one book and then it shows a bunch of suggestions for you. And you think, oh, those are good suggestions. Click, you know, and we get this kind of momentum of attachment happen. And afterwards, it's kind of shocking to us. Like, I didn't need that. Why did I do that? What? So this kind of poem is to ask ourselves, when do we exchange temporary happiness for long-term happiness? And why is it that we're so invested in the short-term high that leads to a crash, as opposed to the long-term contentment, which doesn't fall, you know? And kind of to retrain the mind to have the biggest priority the most times means that your daily life happiness is taken care of. All the incidental everyday stuff settles into place when you have the largest worldview. But it's a very delicate psychology. It's a delicate psychology because if you have a huge goal, it's very easy to overwhelm yourself and become paralyzed with feeling overwhelmed and then not do anything at all or even backslide. Yeah, you know how in Alcoholics Anonymous they always say one day at a time, even though, of course, you want to be free from your addiction your whole life, you say one day at a time. And that's an important psychology because we can manage a day at a time with our afflictions like attachment, anger, jealousy, pride. We can be on top of them a day at a time. But if we think from now until enlightenment, I will never lose my temper, you'll probably lose your temper in the next 5 minutes because it puts too much pressure on you, right? And so in Buddhism, it's very tricky because we have these high ideals and we have these amazing goals. And we talk about what the mind's potential is, and we can be very inspired and excited, and then crash when we realize how long this is going to take. Yeah. And think, well, I wasn't so bad before Buddhism. I was a nice person. I was polite. I got the job done. The Buddhism, it's a bit much, really. Yeah. And it's easy to kind of toss it out, or the other direction, to become so tight in our practice of the Dharma that we turn into some kind of fundamentalist, you know, or we become kind of brittle or precious about the behaviors of Dharma as opposed to the internal attitudes of Dharma. Yeah, we want to look like a good Buddhist, you know, and it becomes maybe even a little performative. So these are the dangers, and I think probably all of us have already seen these dangers, maybe not with Buddhist practice, maybe with any practice to heighten our ethics. You know, maybe we're working on being anti-racist. Maybe we're working on our internalized homophobia. Maybe we're working on being more aware of our impact on the environment. And as soon as we start to do, quote, better, there's all this kind of like embarrassment or resistance of, well, what I was doing before wasn't that bad. Do I really have to change? I mean, the world needs to change, obviously, obviously, but I'm not so bad, right? And you aren't. That's true. You're not so bad. You're probably a very nice person. But as soon as you start challenging those little pockets of prejudice or those little kind of cores of self-centeredness, your ego rebels. Yeah, it goes into massive, no way. Yeah, and then, you know, the whole internal turmoil becomes worse. So I say this as kind of a disclaimer of hear the beautiful poetry of these aspirations with a sense of humor. Yeah, the kind of self-awareness that can really laugh at yourself when you're not in alignment with your highest ideals. You think how important this is to me and how absurd it is that I don't live up to it. Aren't we all ridiculous creatures? And kind of laugh yourself into connection with the human experience rather than feel isolated like you're the bad one that can't live up to it. Yeah, so whenever you feel yourself kind of centralizing or closing in or resisting, try and, you know, consciously open out and realize we're all in it together. And we all have this kind of approach where we mean the best, but actually changing habits is incredibly hard. So we need to be so patient and kind with ourselves as we're trying to shift into better habits. Yeah. And if you can laugh at yourself, that's a sign that you haven't over-identified with your negative states of mind and your problematic behaviors. You've just seen them as things you need to work on, but they're not you. Yeah, you're not bad. There is nothing bad about you. There are some problematic habits, but they're just habits. They're not you. Okay. So as a massive disclaimer for a very simple, sweet text in a lot of ways, this simple, sweet text falls under the heading of the Lojong or thought transformation tradition, which includes things like the 8 verses of thought transformation of Geshe Langri Tampa, or the 7-point mind training of Geshe Chikawa, these kind of texts that you might have come across that have what maybe Venerable Pema Chodron would call mind training slogans, which does sound very American to call it a slogan, like Nike, just do it, or something horrible. But the reason of framing it in that way is that you want one or two lines to stick. and to stick in such a way that it protects your mind from the daily life negative patterns. So it's a whole poem, right? It's quite, you know, it's a couple pages long, but if one or two lines of it you can make your own and bring straight to your heart, what you'll find is it will pop into your mind in daily moments. You're making your cup of tea, you're making your cup of coffee, or you're getting in the car and you notice yourself starting to tense up, starting to get anxious, starting to get overwhelmed or depressed. And through the familiarity of these mind training ideas, a line will pop in and it acts like a circuit breaker. And your agitated mind will kind of go, oh yeah, that's right. And it's like a deep breath for your mind. And that's the way these mind training slogans work, is they're a circuit breaker for your negative patterns. So the more familiar you become with them, the easier they just come into your mind when you need them. Like maybe something your grandmother told you 20 years ago pops into your mind, you know, in a heated moment, and you remember some wisdom she told you, and you go, that's right, that's right, that's how humans are. In a similar way, this can do this kind of thing. So before we get into the text, do you have any questions or areas where you're particularly interested? Anything to clarify right off the bat? Good. Okay. So we're going to do a little PowerPoint. It won't be too long, I promise. Let's see. Where is it? There it is. Okay. So hopefully everybody can see that. So I just want to do some brief vocabulary review, even though I'm thinking that most of you know these words, just so when I'm using them throughout the retreat, you don't get lost. So the big word is bodhicitta. That's the word we're going to keep coming back to again and again. So it's important to know what it means specifically so that we can go into it experientially. So bodhicitta is a Sanskrit word, and in Tibetan, it's janchu kisem. And it means the mind of enlightenment. Sometimes it's translated as the spirit of enlightenment or the heart of enlightenment or the warm heart. There's a lot of different translations in English for bodhicitta, but citta is and sem really mean mind. But in Buddhism, heart and mind live here at the heart chakra, you know, and they of course pervade the rest of the body as well. But they're kind of the same thing, heart, mind. We're not talking about the brain. We're not talking about the physical heart. We're talking about the seat where mental experience is kind of born from. And that's kind of the area that we want to train and get so used to these ideas that they become natural. So it's the main Mahayana motivation. It's the altruistic mind that seeks enlightenment in order to benefit all sentient beings. Okay, so that's like the technical definition, right? It's a Mahayana motivation, the main Mahayana motivation, meaning the great scope or the great vehicle, which means that your goal is something very specific. Your goal is enlightenment. Your goal is not nirvana. Nirvana will come in handy. Nirvana is something that is useful, nirvana slash liberation, right? But nirvana is a state beyond sorrow. It's not the actualization of your fullest potential. Enlightenment is the actualization of your fullest potential. This is what we call Buddhahood. And the reason you want to be a Buddha, as opposed to just getting rid of suffering, is because you want to benefit others. If you didn't want to benefit others, it would be fine to just be free from suffering and to be kind and good and to not hurt anyone. And if we all did that, that would be amazing and fantastic. But bodhicitta is elevated from that. And it's really seeking to get the mind completely purified, not just from its afflictions, but from everything that obscures its knowledge. And because from that place, we can actually benefit others in a specific, accurate way that's not going to do more harm. So there are two bodhicittas in the division that we're talking about in this retreat, ultimate and conventional. You'll sometimes also hear bodhicitta divided into two related to aspiring the intention and engaging the application. Those are related to conventional. So we're not talking about aspiring and engaging precisely today. They are more the conversation that comes up when we talk about bodhisattva vows. So ultimate and conventional bodhicitta are related to basically who is it that has the bodhicitta? Is it someone who's realized reality directly, or is it someone who's still working on it? Yeah, so we'll come back to that, but two main divisions of bodhicitta. The most important is that you understand the word bodhicitta. So then bodhisattva is a word you've heard, right? And this is a being with uncontrived bodhicitta. So it's a person or a someone with the bodhicitta. Meaning they've achieved the Mahayana path of accumulation or higher, which is the first of the five pathway awarenesses one realizes in the process of becoming enlightened, which includes uncontrived renunciation of samsara. So a bodhisattva has both bodhicitta and this determination to be free from cyclic existence. They don't want this pattern of negative behavior anymore. They are disillusioned with it. They're disgusted by it. And they want to break the wheel. So they have that as the basis. And then they bring bodhicitta to it. And to say that it's uncontrived means that it's been practiced so often that they don't have to stop and think about it anymore. It arises naturally, right? It arises spontaneously. It imbues every other thought in their mind. So a being who is called a bodhisattva has uncontrived bodhicitta. So then what about this text, right? The 37 practices of a bodhisattva. These are attitudes to develop in order to develop bodhicitta, become a bodhisattva, and eventually achieve the state of a fully enlightened Buddha. So these are like techniques or like the recipe to become a bodhisattva. And these 37 practices are only found in the Mahayana tradition, and they're not to be confused with a different list of 37. You're going to see 37 aids to awakening, that list that includes things like the four foundations of mindfulness and so on, which are practiced by all three vehicles and found in both the Pali and Sanskrit sutras. So this is a different group of 37. And I've just plopped it in there for those of you that are kind of have a breadth of knowledge about Buddhism and you know your lists and you see 37 and you think it's the same 37. It's not, it's a whole different 37. Okay, so if you didn't know about the 37 aids to awakening, don't worry about it. But for you scholars, that's some context there. So this text, this beautiful presentation of bodhisattva conduct and view has been a major inspiration for the practice and popularity of mind training literature and is enumerated amongst the six basic texts of the Kadampas. So the Kadampa masters are those geshis like Geshe Langri Tampa, Geshe Chekawa, who did really radical reframing. They really transformed their minds to see hardships in a different way. And so Kadampas, like Geshe Tokme Tsangpo, the author of this text, are scholars and practitioners and mind training masters. And so this word Kadampa is not to be confused with the modern day New Kadampa Tradition Organization. The New Kadampa Tradition Organization, we wouldn't consider to be true Kadampas. It's kind of a random offshoot, a little bit culty, a little bit fundamentalist, and they've co-opted this beautiful word and put it into their organization. So sadly, if you see the word Kadampa, it might not actually mean beautiful mind training. It might actually mean this problematic organization. So I just wanted to flag that. But a Kadampa master is a practitioner of the Buddhist tradition that originated in Tibet in the 11th century with the teachings of Lama Atisha, who you know from Lamp to the Path to Enlightenment, one of our main Lam Rim sources. Kadampa Geshes are renowned for their practice of thought transformation is the key point there. Okay, so just having a look at those points, are there any pieces that you wanted to clarify? And if so, go ahead and unmute yourself and jump right in. But those are kind of the main words to know well before we can really get into the text.
Venerable, this is Pamela. I just wanted to ask if uncontrived is the same idea as what we often call a realization.
Yeah, there's a good Venn diagram for that, I'm sure. But to say someone has a realization usually means it's also uncontrived.
Okay.
Yeah, but to say uncontrived, it might not mean a specific realization, or it might. It depends on the translator and the context. So I could say roughly they're synonyms, roughly. But, you know, just kind of in the back of your mind, no, check the context.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, anybody else? How many of you have done some sort of mind training text class before? Just give me a little wave. Yeah. So this is kind of a familiar subject matter to you folks. Is there anyone who's never done any big study on Lojong texts like this one? A couple new folks? Okay. Yeah, that's a good mix. So in a way, people that have done it more often sometimes have better beginner questions, because you sometimes need to hear it a few times before you can articulate your question. So even if you've done this quite a lot, please feel empowered to ask your questions. I think it will help the new people who might not be able to articulate their questions yet because it's still fresh. And also, you know, we're all beginners really in the cosmic sense, so please don't be shy. All right, so I'm going to do a little bit about the author and then just a couple of the intro stuff, and then we're going to do a meditation. So when we do the meditation, it'll be mostly analytical but quite gentle, and it might be a place where some of your questions start bubbling up. So that's how we're going to pace the rest of this session. It's just a little bit more context and then into some meditation. But again, if you have questions along the way, please jump in. Let me just see. Okay. All righty. So here's some biography stuff of the author, and I've compiled the kind of fun, at least fun for me, parts of his biography from a few different texts. So if anyone's curious, down at the bottom of each slide is the source for each respective section. But I just kind of pulled out what was fun for me, hoping it would be fun for you. So Gyaltse Togme Zangpo lived at a time when the sectarian boundaries that characterized the later development in Buddhism in Tibet had not yet been fully drawn. And so an open-minded environment encouraged scholars to travel to various acclaimed monastic centers and pursue their studies in Buddhist philosophy, regardless of the center's philosophical orientation. So this was really a heyday for collaboration. It was really a beautiful time where people hadn't gotten so rigid, like I'm Gelugpa, I'm Kagyu, I'm Sakya, I'm Nyingma, I'm Burmese tradition, I'm Thai tradition. There was just a little bit of a renaissance of collaboration at various times in Buddhist history. And hopefully we'll have another one of those soon. His Holiness is very good at modeling the fact that despite we're Gelugpas, we can learn a lot from all of the other traditions and make sure we keep the Dharma complete by looking at all of the other traditions and seeing what parts they've held as most emphasized. So he lived during this time, and that's an important kind of context to know about him. So he was born in central Tibet in 1295. And he was orphaned at a very early age. His mother died when he was 3, his father 2 years later. His grandmother then looked after him. When she died 4 years later, an uncle took him in. From his uncle, he learned how to read and write, which was a rare accomplishment for ordinary Tibetans in the 14th century. So at this point, he wasn't a monk, right? He was just a little kid who hadn't been put into a monastery, who had a series of quite traumatic losses. And fortunately, he landed with his uncle, who took some charge of his education. So then, encouraged by his uncle, he entered monastic life at the age of 14, which, as you know from probably, I don't know, documentaries and people who are Tibetan, is actually a little bit later in life than some people enter the monastic tradition. Some people enter as really little kids, like 7 or 8, or even 6, but they don't really decide to be monks or nuns until they're 14. They have kind of a trial period of trial vows, or maybe not vows at all, or just refuge vows. They're wearing the robes, they're living the life, but they actually don't have to become monks or nuns when they're little kids. They kind of take that on formally when they're later in life teenagers. So he didn't have that kind of preliminary little kid monastic time, but he did have that pre-education from his uncle. And so when he entered at 14, he did it with a little bit of context, right? He wasn't forced into it, it was his choice. So then from these humble beginnings, Togme Zangpo emerged to become a prodigious scholar, a respected abbot, a devoted practitioner, and an icon of compassion. So when a young monk in the Kadampa tradition, Togme Zangpo quickly mastered the classical curriculum. By the time he was 19, he was being hailed as a second Asanga, his namesake, the great 4th century Indian master. So Togme is Tibetan for Asanga. So by 19, he really had all of the main things under his belt with such proficiency that he was admired by his peers. So he was an amazing scholar, but even at 19, people could see that he was really going in a very beautiful direction with his path. Life in a Tibetan monastery in the 14th century was far from easy. And I would add that life in a Tibetan monastery in the 21st century is also far from easy. While monasteries usually provided food and shelter for all other expenses, from basic personal needs to offerings for training and teaching, a monk depended on relatives, patronage, or the performance of rituals and empowerments to like attract offerings. And some of that is still the case today. It depends on the monastery. Togme Zangpo had no relatives. I think his uncle had passed at this point. And his humble, quiet manner didn't like attract patrons. When he had difficulty in making ends meet, he was advised to perform rituals for the villagers or give empowerments. Such a materialistic approach, using spiritual ceremonies for financial gain, was unthinkable to him. Instead, he sat down and wrote a poem to remind himself of the essential practices of his chosen path. And that poem comes to us, down to us today, as 37 Practices of a Bodhisattva. So this is really remarkable, because back in those times, if you didn't have relatives, you had to be like a fancy monk, right? You had to be a fancy monk and do fancy rituals that kind of awed the lay people and inspired them into going, oh, so amazing, here's some money to support you. So the fact that he wasn't materialistic like that or manipulative like that was really remarkable, because he had few choices. He was really poor. You know, and it would have been quite understandable if he went into the village and did pujas to get offerings. You know, it wouldn't be ideal, but it would have been understandable. So he had such deep inner refuge that he completely rejected that whole worldview and just worked on himself. And he did this poem to inspire him to keep going with the right approach. So when he was 32, he was appointed abbot of a monastery, which in those days wasn't like super young to be appointed as an abbot, but was still pretty young. 9 years later, he refused a subsequent appointment, insisting that a better person be found. So his humility showing itself again. Retiring to a hermitage in Mulchu, which is Silver River, he devoted himself to practice for the next 20 years. Instances of his compassion became legend in Tibet. Beggars refused to take alms from him because they knew he would give him his last cup of barley flour or the robe right off of his back. Soldiers stopped their attacks when he was present, and wolves and sheep played peacefully together in front of him. So I don't know about you, but if you have some sort of Christian background, this kind of could remind you of like St. Francis of Assisi, that because of the power of his compassion, it had this radiating effect that brought out the best in others. So kind of their own violent tendencies subdued naturally because of what a powerful influence he was on those around him. So in Nulchu, in Silver River, Gelsey Togmo remained in strict retreat, but every 3 months until he died, he would emerge and give teachings on mind training and bodhicitta to thousands of people who had flocked from all over the country to meet him. Most gave up concern for the affairs of this life. Devoting themselves to the practice of Dharma, they realized the true meaning of emptiness and compassion. He first showed signs of sickness to encourage his disciples to be diligent, to show how sickness can be used on the spiritual path. When someone asked him if there was any way to prolong his life, Togme Zampo said, "If my being sick will benefit beings, may I be blessed with sickness. If my dying will benefit sentient beings, may I be blessed with death. If my being well will benefit sentient beings, may I be blessed with recovery. This is the prayer made to the three jewels." Which is again the heart of this like thought transformation, which is basically saying, whether it's good news or bad news, it's fuel for my path if I see it that way. So, you know, this can be difficult to understand the way in which someone would see hardships as a blessing. And I think it starts to make us think about maybe some very well-intended, very sweet, new agey people we might have in our life who say everything is a lesson with the connotation of it has been specifically orchestrated and given to you on purpose from some spiritual source, right? Everything happens for a reason, right? You hear some folks say that. And we would say everything happens from a cause, but the reason is something you decide. It can be important or not important. It can be a lesson or not a lesson, but who is it that's deciding that? It's you who's deciding that, right? You can say cancer, horrible, cancer, wonderful, cancer, helpful, cancer, harmful. But to think I have been given the cancer on purpose from the great beyond, in a way disempowers yourself, doesn't it? It can be a little disempowering. It also can avoid a little bit of responsibility because you're feeling like things are always happening to you rather than from you. Yeah. And so to say that Togme Zampo was saying, may I be blessed with this or to be blessed with that, we have to understand what a blessing means in Buddhism. A blessing is not a plea to be saved. It's just we don't have a better word in English. It's not saying, save me, teach me, give me. No. It's saying, may my mind be open and receptive to take everything on the path to transformation. So what is a blessing? That which moves the mind in a positive, constructive direction. That which moves the mind. What moves the mind? You move the mind. But you have to become receptive in order for this to work, right? So no one is injecting you with insight. You're opening yourself up to be inspired. Can you feel the distinction, right? It's a lot more self-directed. And it's not to say that there isn't support from enlightened beings. There is support from enlightened beings. Right? Enlightened beings want nothing but the best for us. They're manifesting in a million different ways to help teach us this or that. But the main thing that enlightened beings want for us is to tame our own minds so we stop hurting ourselves, so we stop hurting other people, right? So what they're wanting to do is offer techniques for transformation. They're not going to slam us with an illness. They can't, right? They can't give us a karma we don't have, right? And then say, here is the blessing of this horrible illness. Take it on the path. No, that's not how we view things, right? Your karma, your negative karma from the past ripened as something negative. Now it's your choice whether to play out the same old pattern and create more of the same, or to stop it in its tracks and to stop creating more of the same. And you can either let it play out with patience and just that karma finishes and exhausts itself, or you can take it on the path to transformation and kind of do two things at once. You can exhaust that negative karma, finish its potency, while at the same time using it as fuel to start positive seeds. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's important to really hear these ancient texts without too much of the filters of how we grew up and what these words were used to meaning. Yeah, things like blessings mean something different in Buddhism. Yeah. Any thoughts about that so far? That's the short and sweet biography of Togme Zangpo. How do you feel about that? He had hardships, he went to the monastery, he studied well, he was in some positions of authority for a while, and then he said, to heck with it, I'm going into retreat. When he was in retreat, he would pop out every few months and give some teachings and then pop back in and then die. So that was his life in a nutshell. Well, it reminds me a little bit of a modern teacher that some of you might know about, His Eminence Chödön Rinpoche, who passed away just a couple of years ago. He very much did similar things. When the Chinese invaded Tibet, he actually didn't flee Tibet. He went to a family home and did retreat in a little room and wore lay clothes and just had his prayer beads. He didn't have any tangas or anything like that, and just practiced for like 18 years, totally humbly, quietly, with no one watching him, until it was time for him to leave. And then he left and went to India and then started teaching. But I mean, he just quietly got the job done, you know? No fanfare, you know? He just sat in his room and did his practice for 20 years almost, you know? And thank goodness there were people around to feed him who, you know, thought that he was worth feeding. But then of course, after he had gained amazing realizations, it seems, of course, it's hard for us to know for sure, he was able to teach in this incredibly expansive way for the rest of his life. And it was really a remarkable thing. So, you know, a lot of the lesson here is about kind of humble, quiet confidence. Yeah, a confidence that is humble, that has nothing to prove. You know, yeah, I see something in the chat. Let's see, first experience with Buddhism and finding it interesting. So thanks, Caitlin. Yeah, it's a lot to take on, right? All at once, it's a lot to take on, but take the pieces that resonate right away and kind of mull them over. And the parts that aren't making sense, you can just come back to it or leave it if it doesn't work for you. So you probably heard this before, but you don't need to be Buddhist to practice Buddhism, right? It's your choice. And we offer it freely. You take what's useful, and we're not missionaries or proselytizing. And, you know, Buddhism might not be right for everyone, but there might be bits that are useful. So take what is and leave what isn't. Yeah, Pamela.
Venerable, I wanted to ask about when he said that if it's a blessing for me to be sick, and benefits all beings, then that may it be so, and so on, if I die or if I live on healthy. I'm not sure how to ask this, but what I'm wondering is, in what context does he say that with respect to rebirth? Like, is he such a beautiful practitioner that rebirth is just not built into that statement? Or is there some way in which it's built in that you could explain?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think what he's saying, I think, is if it's useful for sentient beings to see me working with the Dharma while sick, let's do that. If it's useful for me, for sentient beings to see me well and healthy while practicing, let that be the case. And what he's doing is he's giving himself a mental attitude where he's not fussed. Yeah, he's saying everything is workable. Everything is workable. May I adopt this attitude where I don't compound suffering with resistance to suffering? And it's also a way to relax the mind and say, if it's useful for me to die, I'll die. And part of the confidence comes from, if you have bodhicitta, uncontrived bodhicitta, your mind is protected. You've protected your own mind, which means whatever your rebirth is, it's going to be a positive one, conducive to continuing your spiritual path, right? You're not going to slip into an animal realm and spend 20 years as a dog and forget everything, you know, because if you have bodhicitta, your launch to your next life is pretty much guaranteed to be a good one. So he doesn't have a fear in the same way that maybe we have a fear of death because we don't know what is next. Of course, even an ordinary person can have a really good rebirth if they die with a peaceful mind, or if in the intermediate state or in the bardo, there's positive influences to ripen positive seeds. So we might be fine, but he was probably at the stage where he was golden, right? He'd be like, I shall be reborn in India to these nice parents with good ethics and stable financial situation. Bing! Whereas for us, we don't have that kind of control, right? We're just kind of blown by karma. Yeah. Yeah, and Kevin's just appreciating that I mentioned about the New Kadampa tradition. Yeah, those folks, there's some people that mean well within that organization, of course, as in all organizations, but the organization itself is pretty toxic and worth avoiding, unfortunately. Fundamentalism will creep into everything, so, you know, buyer beware. Right. And of course, whatever documentaries you've watched about cults, you know, we all love a good cult documentary. Yeah. Who's with me? Yeah. you know, if you have the sinking feeling of, you know, listen to that if you're going anywhere. Yeah. Especially if they start saying, give me all your money, stop talking to your relatives, only follow this teacher and no other teacher. Your ears go, that sounds culty. Right. Yeah. It'll happen to anything, degenerate age. So Togme Zampo as a person, do you have kind of a sense of him? Is there any questions you wanted to ask about him? You've set the scene. Okay, so we'll jump into the text just a little bit, and then we'll do a meditation to kind of anchor in. So here's just the first piece of the outline. And some people are outline people and some people aren't. It doesn't matter. It's just to kind of give you a framework. Verses 1 through 7 are basically preparation for bodhicitta or preparation for deeper practice. And these preliminaries, they seem like they're less significant because they're called preliminaries, but they're actually essential foundations that everything else is going to be a bit rocky if you don't touch into these first. So verse 1 is going to be about the need to give meaning to this human existence of yours, so rare and difficult to obtain. And verse 2 is going to be about abandoning your native land, the source of the three poisons. To say your native land, you can read it literally, but actually what is meant is your habitual conditioning towards anger, attachment, and ignorance. Yeah, that's your native land, or your default setting is to be somewhat afflicted and self-centered. So we want to kind of consciously abandon that, quote, native land. The third verse is going to be about living in solitary places, the source of all good qualities. And again, you can see it literally as, you know, live somewhere quiet and not too busy. But what it really means is minimize distractions. Yeah, inner distractions, outer distractions, actively work to simplify your life, because with less busyness, it's easier to focus, just really straightforward. Yeah. And then we have Fourth, giving up the concerns of this life by reflecting on impermanence. And what that means is that your priorities shift from this life to the future. And if you don't believe in future lives, the way to think of this is in terms of like legacy. What is the legacy you want your life to leave behind you when you die? Do you want a legacy of healthy, compassionate relationships where people are better off having met you? Or do you want a legacy of, you know, trauma and criticism and all that kind of, you know, divisive horribleness? And of course, we're all a mixed bag and we make mistakes. But in terms of thinking of your future, it helps to remember impermanence, meaning that things change, meaning that this life will end. So if you're keeping death in the forefront of your mind, it's much easier to synchronize with your priorities and to not forget the important things that you value. If you forget about change, it's easier to kind of make things too concrete, to make things too always or never or finite, and you get kind of blinkered views. And so impermanence really helps shake us loose of that. Then fifth is avoiding unsuitable friends whose company creates conditions unfavorable to your progress. So, you know, that sounds tricky because of course we don't want to avoid anyone in the sense of blocking our heart, but it does mean that there are some groups that we could gently, skillfully move away from purely because our mind is not yet disciplined enough to not be negatively influenced. If we are very strong in our positive habituation, we can be with anyone and it can be beneficial to them. It cannot sway us. It's fine. We could be in a den of thieves and only be a good influence. But here in the preliminaries, it's recognizing that our training is new and it might be worthwhile examining, are there some areas or some friend groups where the best is not being brought out of us and we are not bringing out the best in others? And maybe we need to gently distance ourselves, at least for now. Then sixth is relying on a spiritual teacher whose presence creates conditions favorable to your progress. And seventh is going for refuge. So we'll unpack those, but just to kind of give you a reference of what the first part is about before it gets into like specifically bodhicitta. So then we'll go into these a little bit more later. But just to start with the text itself, this is the introduction and the opening verses. And this particular translation is from Lotsawa House, and I really like it. I think on the website, I put a different translation because it was so beautifully formatted and the PDF was so pretty, but I actually prefer this translation. So if you want that, the link will be in the chat, but also I'll be putting it up on the screen. So it says, Namo Lokeshvaraye, you see that all things are beyond coming and going, yet still you strive solely for the sake of living beings. To you, my precious guru, inseparable from Avalokita, I offer perpetual homage, respectfully with body, speech, and mind. The perfect Buddhas, who are the source of all benefit and joy, come into being through accomplishing the sacred Dharma. And since this, in turn, depends on knowing how to practice, I shall now describe the practices of all the Buddha's heirs. So this Namo Lokeshvaraye, Namo means I pay homage. Loka signifies the world or universe. Ishvara, all-powerful master. Thus, this first line means I pay homage to you, the Lord of the universe, you know, so grand, right? The Lord of the universe, though, means Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara is compassion itself, appearing in the form of a deity. Aware of the suffering of all living beings, he is known in Tibetan as Chenrezig, which means he who sees all. So Avalokiteshvara, Chenrezig, this Buddha of compassion, who you see the picture of, manifests in whatever form is appropriate to help beings. as a Buddha, as a Bodhisattva of the 10th level, a deity, a spiritual teacher, or even as an ordinary person or an animal. Great Bodhisattvas like Avalokiteshvara manifest in our world for the benefit of living beings. And so, you know, in modern times, we think that Avalokiteshvara in human form or his human emanation or human aspect is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who of course just looks like a regular person, sweet old Tibetan man. You can talk to him, he's relatable, but we think he's showing the aspect of being in this form in order to connect to living beings, when in actuality, if we had purified karma, we would see him as this figure with, you know, 11 heads and 1,000 arms and an eye in each palm to see the suffering of all sentient beings, or in this forearm version representing the forearm of four immeasurables, you know, this kind of magical, beatific form, this kind of archetype of compassion. If we had purified karma, that's what we see. But because our karma isn't pure, we at least get to see the human being manifesting these qualities, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So in these opening verses, then this underlined section that says, through accomplishing the sacred Dharma, that's how perfect Buddhas, who are the source of all benefit and joy, come into being, right? They come into being through accomplishing or practicing Dharma. And they're the source of all benefit and happiness or joy, not in like the substantial cause, but in terms of a condition. So this in turn depends on knowing how to practice. So I shall now describe the practices of all the Buddha's heirs. So this guru or teacher is seen as one in nature with great compassion, Chenrezig Avalokiteshvara. And our Buddhahood or their Buddhahood relies on the guru and the three jewels, namely the internally realized Dharma jewel. So the guru is an interesting concept in Tibetan Buddhism, in Buddhism in general. It's an attitude that we need to adopt. And it's very easily misunderstood, and it can sound a little triggering, especially if we have authority issues or trauma from previous relationships in other religions. So the word guru, you know, we want some objectivity and kind of analyze it before really making up our mind about what it means to us. But when we say the guru or the teacher is one in nature with Chenrezig, what we're saying is we're picking a person to be the mouthpiece for Buddhas for us. Yeah, we're picking a person. It helps to pick a person who's reliable, right? If you pick a person who turns out to be a bit dodgy, it's going to be harder for you to practice the Dharma. But if you've ever tried learning something purely through books, and then you go to like one seminar about it with a person live, it's like you learn everything in all of the books in 2 hours, right? Have you had that experience, right? So the in-person transmission of wisdom is so much more direct and efficient than just learning things from books or doing it on your own. That's one piece, and that's very practical. That's seen in worldly convention, right? It's not just about Buddhism. It's easier to learn things from a human being talking to you, right? The other piece, though, is that we need to be somewhat inspired that these things that we've read about actually work. Yeah, like it sounds great, Buddhas, yay, you know, but if you've never met someone who seems significantly better off because of having practiced Dharma, it's hard to be inspired. Yeah, and I mean better off in terms of their happiness, well-being, and kindness seems to be supported by something more than just conventional wisdom. You know, they seem to have some sort of momentum that's keeping them progressing in a way that seems more than. Yeah. And the training is the tricky part, because the training is to see this person as either the representative of the Buddha or as one in nature with the Buddha themselves when you're going into Tantric Buddhism, which is very delicate if you have a real human being in front of you, because you can start doing all sorts of mental gymnastics and over-interpretation to try and figure out what the Buddhas are trying to tell you, when in fact the human being might just have a head cold, right? And they're a bit grumpy that day, and you're trying to interpret it as some mystical message to you, when in fact it's just they've got a cold, like talk to them the next day. Yeah, we can get kind of funny about it. But there is also a profundity in thinking even this head cold that they're showing might be some sort of teaching for me if I were to view it in the right way. So it's delicate because you want to have a closeness, but not too close with your teacher. Because if you get too close, the ordinary aspect of a human being is going to break the spell. Right? If you spend too much time with anyone, the cracks are going to appear. And that will then kind of devastate your practice if your practice is new. Now, once you integrate the guru and have the inner guru fully woken up and able to receive information and just kind of really alive within you, then you start hearing the guru in everything. Yeah. And it doesn't matter about the initial person who was your guru. You start hearing that deep wisdom from all sorts of sources, and you can just keep weaving it into your own mind and becoming stronger and stronger because of it. But in the beginning, having a relationship with the person who embodies the Dharma for you is really important, but really delicate. Yeah. So you want to be able to see the way in which they might be a regular person, but they have become a transmission device for enlightened words for you. Yeah, they're like a gateway or like an opening, which is why you don't want to jump into a relationship with a teacher without checking them, right? You want to really check them over some time. You want to make sure their ethics are consistent, that their mood is fairly even, and that their knowledge is sound. Those are things you can check. Now, realizations are things that you hope they have, but you can't honestly know if they have a realization or not, because you cannot take another person's measure, right? You can't. It's all just educated guesses. So what you do is you really examine the ethics and make sure this person is stable and that there's not some sort of, I don't know, creepy stories about, I don't know, relationships or exploitation of any kind or financial weirdness or anything like that, the classics, right? And that there, if there are stories like that, that you investigate and follow up. Because of course, some people sometimes get weird rumors that totally aren't true. But, you know, often where there's smoke, there's fire. So follow up and check and check and check. Yeah. The traditional Lam Rim texts say it's good to check your teacher for like 12 years, right? And who's got that kind of time, right? But please wait more than 12 hours, please, right? If you can't do 12 years, please wait more than 12 hours, because anybody is cool for 12 hours, right? The power of charisma, everybody's amazing for the first 12 hours. And then, like, you know, the shine wears off and you go, oh, right, never mind, right? So give it some time. Most teachers would say, you know, at least a year of checking or a couple years of checking. Some teachers would, you know, say longer, because it's a mutual checking of both the student and the teacher. But there are some big teachers like His Holiness who are happy to become everyone's heart connection immediately because of the power of their practice. They're up for it. But those are rare cases. Yeah. All right, so any questions so far before we do our meditation?
Venerable, I've got a question, if that's okay.
Sure.
It seems like relying on a teacher, it very specifically a singular teacher, one person. Is that, what's the level of importance for that? Or are we able to accept teachings from several people? Or is there a kind of distinction there that we should be making?
Yeah, it's a good question. And in the beginning, you know, shop around, right? In the beginning, really check out lots of teachers and go to lots of teachings, and kind of feel your way into maybe a community or a tradition more than the main teacher. Some people, it's the main teacher first, then the community and the tradition. It depends on, you know, just how it all plays out. But I think that, you know, getting to know a few different styles and getting to know a few different communities is really useful. And then you build into, you know, you keep wanting to go back to a certain teacher's teachings. And the wanting to keep going back to their specific teachings usually means that they're resonating with your karmic style or your personality type or your learning style, but there's something similar between you, actually. It's kind of like they're a few steps ahead of you, but it's the same direction and it's the same style. Like if you were to meet my teacher, you would see many students of a similar type to myself, right? Because we're all a little bit like him. We're just the baby version. Like we're the baby version of him and he's the grown-up version, but there's something in common, like about the way in which we articulate ourselves and our style of humor. And, you know, it's just like, oh, that's a Geshe Tashi Sering student. Okay. And not Geshe Tashi Sering Jumyoung, but the one in Australia. But, you know, it's interesting to see. But that's not to say you only have one. I think it's useful to have one or two that are your main go-to teachers, who become like your root gurus, right? Like your heart teachers who almost speak in your voice. If your voice was free of all its mess, you know, like what your own wisdom says to you in a slightly elevated form, they're somehow like you. It's hard to explain, but you know it when you feel that resonance and that affinity with someone, that this person is going in a direction I can follow. And then there might be other teachers who are excellent teachers, but they're just not your style. You know, you're not vibing with them and it's fine and you don't need to force it. And it might be that they're teaching a text you really like. And so you'll go to their class because you're curious about that text, but that doesn't mean that you're taking them on as a heart teacher. It's just more like going to a university class with a professor who you know knows the subject, you know? So over time, you might start weaving in a couple more, but it is useful to streamline it and just have a couple, like one or two, who are your go-tos, and then a few kind of peripheral ones. Yeah. It can be difficult, I think, if you have too many and they have slightly different approaches, it makes it harder to decide what you specifically should do on your cushion. You know, you'll have three different good advice and they're all good advice, but now you're kind of paralyzed with overwhelm. You've got too many options. And so it's better to just, I'll do the way you say it because that is more efficient and I'll actually do it. Yeah. But eventually over time, like Chöden Rinpoche, who I mentioned before, when he passed away, it almost felt like his voice then just kind of was living in my head now, because it's like, his wisdom was something I accessed, and now I can hear it again when I listen for it. And not in some weird medium way, not in some, you know, nothing like that. It's just that I got to know his style. So now I know what he would say in any given situation if I just stop and think about it. You know, I can hear his voice in my head, even though his voice is not in my head. And it's a powerful experience. Yeah. Ladan, did you?
Yes. Yes, I have a question about the free will and the karma in the when you have to choose your teacher. Is it come to you and you just open to it, as you said, because you answer kind of my question?
Or, well, yeah. I mean, there's,
you know,
free will.
When it's right. Negative. Sorry.
There is free will, right? There's always free will, but it's conventional free will, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, in the bottom of, in the depth of that choice is always the karma that is leading us, right?
Well,
so we have to...
But what is karma? Karma is your own mind, right? Karma is not some like extra little demon or little angel saying, go this way, go that way. It's just your own habits, right? It's just your own mental habits. So of course, part of you is going to be drawn to someone who is not good for you. Mm-hmm. And part of you is going to be drawn to someone who is good for you. And that's why this deep self-knowing of when are you motivated by afflictions and when are you motivated by higher ideals? And the easiest way to tell is if there's agitation. You know, if you're feeling anxious and agitated, don't make decisions from that place. Mm-hmm. You still might make the decision that you were going to make, but don't make it right then. Yeah. You know, like if you meet His Holiness, you'll probably be excited, right? It's exciting to meet His Holiness and you're like, yay, His Holiness, you know, like seeing a rock star or something. And that doesn't mean He shouldn't be your teacher or should be your teacher. It means don't decide while you're excited, right? Mm-hmm. Wait till you're not excited and then mm-hmm. assess it with some objectivity and think, yeah, honestly, His style touches my heart. Whenever I follow His advice, I am more effective and calm and kind. Yep, He's one of the ones for me. Okay, I'm all in, you know, but you need to have that the first level of kind of excited, bouncy, settle. Because it's very easy for people to project their family of origin issues on a guru and make them into their father or their mother, right? And all of the things their father or their mother didn't give them, now the guru is supposed to give them. And then if you know Tibetans, they are not very sentimental and they're not very, let's lead you step by step and spoon feed you. They're kind of like, here's the Dharma, now do it. Talk to me later when you've tried, you know? They're not going to be sweet about it, right? But, you know, that said, like, we all need to kind of know our own issues, I think, going into a guru relationship, because there's no getting around the fact that we all have baggage. And if you're making a deep commitment to anyone or anything, all your old baggage is going to come up with it. And that doesn't mean it's a bad decision. It just means know that and manage that and be aware of those old triggers. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because just like some people make their guru into their mother or their father, some of them make them into their partner they never had or the partner they wish they had, you know, and it gets all kind of tied with some sort of romantic weirdness and it gets all kind of tangled that way. And then there's jealousy and heartbreak and it's like, whoa, settle down, right? Yeah. Which is normal, yeah, because the Dharma is inspiring. And when is our other association of being inspired? Parental love or romantic love? And so we often kind of just like tie our old associations with inspiration to this new relationship, you know? And so it's natural and it's nothing to be ashamed of. It's just something to notice and consciously disengage from. Mm-hmm. But was that your question?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So let's see. We could have a short meditation now, or we could start the next session with a meditation. What would you prefer? Do you want to break now and come back and start with meditation? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Are there any miscellaneous questions? We've got a few minutes before a break. Yeah, go ahead, Christina.
Hello, thank you. So one question I have is, when I've studied about deities, it's the representation of some qualities.
Yeah.
But then sometimes in the text or the way it's presented, it talks about something physical, as the little text you read before, that they can turn into another human being or animal to help all sentient beings. What's the understanding? Because I find it a bit confusing, sorry.
Yeah, it is confusing. It really is. And it starts to, you know, kind of mix in with our ideas of like archetypes, right? You know, like what is the archetypal mother? Is that the same as Tara and Mary and the goddess of the earth and all of the things? And we'll just make her green for now, but it could be the same, whatever, right? And what we're talking about with deities is like a few layers of meaning. So there's layers, right? So take just the concept compassion. Okay, so compassion is the aspiration for all sentient beings to be free from suffering. And compassion is something that we've experienced on the receiving end and we've experienced on the giving end. It's not been perfect and untainted by ego, but it's been something and we know it, right? We know compassion. And then when we're trying to think about, I would like to have more compassion and embody it, and I would like to receive more compassion and feel it, it helps the mind to personify it and make it into an image like this. But this particular image came from an enlightened mind. It came from the enlightened mind of all the Buddhas who said, this size, shape, color, balance, aspect, if you direct your mind towards it, it will help organize your mind towards this quality. And they actually become like teaching tools or old-fashioned charts, you know, like this one. There's like, you know, the four immeasurables, love, compassion, joy, equanimity. And, you know, each part means something, like the lotus is renunciation. And then we have, you know, bodhicitta and correct view that he's sitting on. And they all mean something. But when you're meditating, it's like all of the knowledge of what it means imbues the image, but you're not thinking about it concretely in that moment. It's more just imbuing it or coloring it. Yeah. And even before you know the imagery, there's some sort of impact it has on your mind because of who it is that created it, and enlightened minds created it. So there's that level, but there's also the level of the Dharmakaya mind of all the Buddhas. So everyone who's ever become enlightened has the same skills, right? The same abilities, the same happiness in their mind, the same love for everyone else. But before they were Buddhas, they had individual lives. They were regular people like us and had different habits and tendencies. And some, you know, some beings, when they were on the path, were really focused on helping those with mental illness like depression and anxiety. So like Medicine Buddha and the Medicine Buddhas, right? And some of them were really focused on action and protection and swiftness and using kind of more wind energy. And there you get Tara, right? And so when a person was on the path, they started to trend a certain way with their path, and their energy was directed more specifically in certain areas than others. So even though they have the skill to do anything, they kind of manifest something specific for our sake, and also because of their habituation. So it's an interesting thing. So you're thinking, you know, if I pray to Tara, she's for action and protection, but can I pray to her for compassion? Oh no, that's not what she's for. Well, of course she could do that too, right? If you're like Tara, Tara can be everything, no problem. But sometimes it helps us shifting gears to turn to these different aspects to help focus our mind in really, really specific ways. So the Dharmakaya mind of all the Buddhas, think of it like the ocean with countless water molecules. And all the water molecules are separate water molecules, but you can't really see the difference between them when they're all in the ocean and you don't have a microscope. So that's like all the Buddhas, right, are like the ocean. And then the ocean can make waves that are a certain size and shape, just like the Buddhas can kind of manifest as Chenrezig or manifest as Tara, right? Like they're just waves in the ocean showing a shape for our sake, you know? So they're all equal, they're all the same, but they adopt these different personas in order to help us direct our mind. One from the perspective of inspiration, two from the perspective of karma. So karmically, we might not be able to see Chenrezig, even though we need Chenrezig and we're focused on compassion. That might not be what appears to us in our daily life, but we have our pet, right? We have our little dog or our little cat or some sweet creature in our life who might just be a cat, or they might be a Buddha manifesting as a cat so that we'll do more actions of generosity and get soothing. Right? So we don't know what our cat is. Our cat might just be a naughty creature, just as it seems, or it might be that that is what we have the karma to see and engage with. And through that relationship, we're able to develop on the path. So it's Chenrezig looking like a cat, right? In a cat suit, little cat suit, Chenrezig. So there's always these levels of meaning in Buddhism, and it's easy to get kind of mixed up, but you're really asking yourself, at what level can I engage with practice? And it's going to really benefit my mind to go in this direction. Because there's also like folk stories of all the deities, right? How this one came to look this way and this one came to look this way. And the person who was a real person before they became Tara, but then all the Buddhas can take on Tara-ness if they want to, you know? So there's these levels. If you're thinking of your own teacher, when they are giving a tantric empowerment, you see them as that deity specifically. But then, you know, 2 months later, they might give another empowerment of a different deity. You see them as that deity during that empowerment. You know, it's like they're wearing a Tara suit or they're wearing a Chenrezig suit for your sake in that moment. Did it make it too complicated or less? I don't know.
It's really interesting, but I need to think about it. It's a lot of...
Yeah, it's a lot of layers.
Thank you. No, it was really, really useful. Thank you.
Good. Yeah, it's an interesting one to play with, but I think that if you're asking yourself what helps direct your mind towards what is positive and beneficial, and we're going to do a compassion meditation after this, it helps to have something intellectual and concrete in your mind. It helps to have something inspirational and visualized and beautiful in your mind. It helps to have a sound. It helps to have a touch. And if you bring as many senses under your control as possible and direct them to one simple thing, compassion, compassion has more of a chance to get in you, right? Or to wake up within you and strengthen. You know, you could just think about it, or you could just visualize it, or you could just do the mantra, you know, and all of that would be useful. But if you bring multitasking, which your brain already does, into one simple thing, then your senses aren't working against you anymore, distracting you anymore. You've brought them into alignment, all directed on one thing, and it can be a really efficient way to practice. So we'll just experiment with that after the break. Any last minute thoughts before we stretch? Good. Okay, we'll dedicate and then have a half hour break. Janja Semcho Rinpoche Ma Ke Panam Ke Gyochi Ke Panyam Pame Pahi Gone Gondu Kawasho Tori Dawa Rinpoche Ma ke panam ke gyuchi, ke panyam pa me pahi, gone gondu pawasho.